This is an interview with Ambassador Jorge Montaño on October 1st, 1999, in Mexico City, in Mexico. And so first, for the record, Ambassador Montaño, would you explain where you were born and educated and when you became involved in your country's foreign service?
Yes, I was born in Mexico City in August 1945. And I was educated at the National University, Mexico. I have a law degree and a political science degree. And then I went to do a PhD at the London School of Economics. I wrote a thesis on political sociology. And I've been doing research at different academic institutions in Mexico and abroad. And I have several books published on political sociology and international relations. I became a member of the Foreign Service of Mexico in 1979, and I've been a member of then of the service for almost 20 years. I went through different positions in the Foreign Service, mainly at the Foreign Affairs Ministry. I was Director General, then I was Assistant Secretary, Under Secretary, and then I went to the UN as permanent representative, and later I became ambassador of Mexico to the United States. At the time being, I have a special permission to be out of the service for 2 years. I'm doing research and I'm also working in a private fund, private activities.
Okay, great, thank you. What years were you at the UN?
I was at the UN from December 1988 until January 1993.
Okay, so 1988 to 1993. Well, would you be able to explain, for the record, for history, Mexico's role in the Contadora process?
Okay, I just want to say that I would want to add that before becoming permanent representative at the UN, I was Assistant Secretary in charge of multilateral affairs. And as such, I had to deal from 1982 to 88 during the La Madrid administrations with all the positions of Mexico in the various multilateral fora, that is mainly for the purpose of this research, the UN and the Human Rights Commission, and of course the OAS, and the various bodies of the OAS that were competent or trying to be, or at least they tried to be competent in the Central American conflict. So then I had sort of a general overview. It was my responsibility to follow the various activities of Mexico in the different fora. And as you're aware, the Mexico had a leading role in the different for not only the UN or the General Assembly, but also at the specialized agencies such as UNESCO, or ILO, and others, FAO, that had an important role to play during the conflict in Central America. As far as Contador is concerned, I was also part of the team who gave support to the Contadora team, mainly from Mexico, and preparing documents and doing helping negotiations, and obviously getting the support for Contadora in the multilateral fora. So that's the part that I really play the most, trying to get my country being the leading force or one of the leading forces. Trying to get not only support for Contadora, but also support for some of the resolutions that were very dear to us. For instance, the ones on human rights, that Mexico was the leader in the Human Rights Commission in Geneva, and also the third committee in New York, and also the OAS, trying to condemn the massive violations of human rights in El Salvador, massive violations of human rights in Guatemala, and in all the countries. But I mean, for the purpose of this, it's important only to mention those. It is important to recall that at that time also we had important violations of human rights in Chile, that Mexico was also the leading force. So in fact, that was mainly the role that we played during the Contadora process. The multilateral fora were extremely supportive of Contadora, trying to get and to bring to the table people from Europe, in Asia, trying to convince them that it was important for them to participate closely with the efforts made by the four original Contadora countries, and then the support group, and lately the Rio group. So in a way, it was a dual track. One was the one play in the region, and the other one play mainly in the multilateral forum.
Okay. Well, as long as you were so closely involved with Contadora, what's your evaluation of the process itself?
Well, I think the process was a very relevant, significant one. In fact, as you probably recall, at the beginning of the conflict in Central America, mainly in El Salvador, mainly in Nicaragua, mm-hmm. Mexico became very active in 1979 and went out of its traditional principles in foreign policy, and we condemned Somoza and we asked for Nicaragua to be expelled from the OAS, which was fairly new as an activity of Mexico. The then President López Portillo became closely linked to the new government in El Salvador and in Nicaragua. We helped them a lot. Lately, in 1981, Mexico went out again from the point of view mainly of, let's say, moderate or perhaps conservative groups. We went out of our track again, supporting what it was called the a common position between Mexico and France regarding El Salvador. This was an important communique that recognized the FMLN, FDR as belligerent forces that, according with the Geneva Convention, gave the FMLN and the FDR the protection of such agreements. So Mexico with France had to play that important role. There was very...
And then I wanted to just emphasize that for a moment, because that became a key factor later in being able to negotiate with the FMLN. So when was that, and how did that evolve?
Well, that was in 1981 is the Mexico-French communique that and evolved, let's say, created some noise in the region. Some countries were forced by the U.S. at that time to become very critical of the Mexican position, and mainly countries like Venezuela. One has to recall that in those days, beginning of 82, the new government in the United States, headed by President Reagan, was very much against any effort of the region, and it was not sympathetic at all about what the Mexicans were doing. I'm not talking about Contadora yet, because Contadora was created until January 1983. But in 82, it was obvious for the new administration in the US that Mexico was too active and didn't want Mexico to be that active. So that's why Mexico looked for support outside of the continent, and the new government headed by Mr. Mitterrand gave that support. So that's why it was so important. Probably she's not over there.
Okay.
So I guess that particular point about why Mexico decided to move with France is because we were sort of feeling like the new U.S. administration was going to be extremely harsh with Mexico, and we wanted to have a permanent member of the Security Council, an important ally at the then so-called European community, and someone who could give us the support and also the political leverage and also the endorsement that we needed for our work in the region. I'm talking about 82 now. Mm-hmm. 82 was the last year of President López Portillo, and it was a difficult year for Mexico in economic terms. However, we kept a very close support mainly to Nicaragua. Mexico was the one who gave more material support and also technical assistance in that first part to the Nicaraguan government. That sort of created us a bad atmosphere in Washington. We were aware of that. But so we kept working until the new administration in Mexico came into office with President de la Madrid at the end of 82, December 82. And soon in 83, that is a month later, we get together in the Contadora Island with Venezuela, Colombia, Panama, and Mexico. We have discussed a lot about
a minute, but who initiated that meeting in Contadora, and why were those countries invited?
Precisely, that was what I was going to say.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's a great debate about what was first, you know, the egg or the chicken. It's a debate, but all I can say is that Mexico played a very key role trying to put together. We sort of thought it was important not only to give support to Central America or to Nicaragua, perhaps that was less important, but we wanted to give instead of quantity, quality. Instead of more trucks or buses, we wanted to give the real political support that was badly needed. And that's why with Venezuela, I would say that Venezuela and Mexico were the leading forces. Although President Betancourt from Colombia also played a key role then. But perhaps the most important part is that the four countries decided to get together, and they sort of accepted the Contadora Island as a place. For Mexico was important because we didn't want to appear at the eyes of the United States as the ones who were the protagonic ones. And we had at that time a very critical internal situation in Mexico, an economic crisis. And we had also a very hostile attitude from the U.S. administration. And so we didn't want to appear as the enfant terrible of the picture. Mm-hmm. And we accepted to have the meeting outside of our country. However, that doesn't mean that the U.S. Accepted that Mexico was not playing a key role. On the contrary, they always found, as probably you recall, our fingerprints everywhere, and they always thought that although we always sort of had a different spokesperson and spoke country, they always claimed that Mexico was the leaders of this initiative, that they found unfriendly against the U.S. interest, and that was the position of General Hay and the president personally. And became a very thorny kind of issue between Mexico and the United States, you know, from then onwards. However, we moved from doing something bilateral to something, let's say, regional. The U.S. Kept a strong pressure on Mexico for our activities in the region.
Well, the Contadora process was not able to end the civil strife. And did the Esquipulas evolve out of Contadora, or what's the relationship?
Well, in my view, this is my very personal view, personal appreciation of the events. I think that the reason why Contadora didn't achieve the purpose of pacifying the region was because the U.S. exercised a lot of pressure in the Central American countries. And if you look at the last document of Contadora and you look at what Mr. Arias put together, Mr. Arias didn't do anything except changing the name of the act and moving all the Central Americans to Esquipulas and getting rid of the Contadora group. You know, in fact, that if you have a, you wanted to find a better example of someone violating all the international conventions on intellectual property. You can find that as a good example. What Arias did was simply to reproduce all the Contadora statements and change into a different stationery with the national emblem of Costa Rica, and that was it. But the pressure exercised by the U.S. on the presidents, saying we can go along with you as long as the Contadora group is not behind you. So that's why they sort of change gears and decided this is a Central American issue, and they used that as an excuse. I think that was a good work from the U.S. diplomacy for removing the Contadora countries, and mainly Mexico, and getting rid of us, not only for the purpose of the Nobel Prize, Peace Nobel Prize, but mainly for they didn't want us to have a leverage in the region. So that's why the U.S. made that effort, and that's what explains, from my point of view, why we moved from the Contadora spirit to the Esquipulas spirit. However, in our view, that was not important. What was important is to have peace in the region. But I think Contadora played a most important role. That is, Contadora was the main obstacle for the freedom fighters from Mr. Reagan to get to invade Nicaragua and to do other things. I think Contadora was, in a way, a tremendous force of political integrity, of moral force that impede, let's say, the most radicals in the U.S. government not to move into the arena of invading Nicaragua. In fact, we kept working very closely with Central Americans and mainly with the Nicaraguans, as a region, trying to give them support, for instance, when the mines on the ports of Nicaragua, mm-hmm. explaining people in the U.S. Congress about what the U.S. were doing and why we were not pleased with the flow of money into the region, for the flow of arms into the region. Mm-hmm. We were certainly concerned about the fact that this was a matter of national security for Mexico. The number of people coming into Mexico, perhaps going into the United States, all the staying in Mexico were growing by the day. People who were not considered refugees, but in fact they were, yeah. moving into Mexico and the United States were growing by the day. We also had a number of arms coming into our country. So for us, was not the President Reagan also claimed that Central America was in the backyard of the United States. For us, it was part of us. It was mm-hmm. not a backyard, it's part of us, you know. Mm-hmm. We are so close, that so integrated, and racially, culturally, politically, that for us was unavoidable to work with them, you know. Of the four countries in Contadora and of the eight countries of the support group, Mexico was the one closer to the region, you know. We had Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, and Nicaragua is closer than many states of Mexico to Mexico City, you know. Mm-hmm. And so for us it was extremely important. So that's why I think Contadora played a very key role in this, even if they don't sort of, we don't receive, you know, the last recognition for the motherhood of parenthood of the peace process. And that doesn't really matter, because history will make very clear that one day or another, that the last document that we presented was exactly the same document that the presidents approved, except that it was not with the support of Contadora, but with the support of Mr. Arias.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I understand that there had been direct connections between the U.S. State Department and Oscar Arias.
Absolutely, I think Oscar Arias received, you know, that, you know, directly from Washington, and it was very clear that That was just a maneuver to get rid of the Contadora group.
What was the evolution from the four countries in Contadora to the eight countries and in the Rio group?
Well, we soon realized that the Contadora effort had limits, and it was important also not only to achieve the peace in the region, but also to have economic development. So we moved to invite countries that were coming out of the dictatorship at the time. They had the first democratic government in many years. So the reason why I invite, for instance, a country so remote for Central America like Argentina, even Peru, is because we thought that it was important to have also an economic front. And remember that all these countries in the region were struggling for the same thing, debt. So we wanted to have a common front on economic development, on debt, on the position of our countries in the financial institutions, international financial institutions. Mm-hmm. So that's why that was, let's say, the carrot to bring into the same boat the South American countries, you know, the new democracies there. And soon we had, we were, instead of four, we were eight, mm-hmm. and then we became 12 in Acapulco in 1987. But yeah, at that time, all with the aim of having economic cooperation among ourselves.
So was the conflicts that were ongoing in Central America a threat to the economic development of Latin America as a whole, as well as the security?
I don't really see it that way. You know, I think that in a way the way we see it was we saw it was that the conflicts in the region were, let's say, a threat to the security, but let's say the reason why you have those conflicts was economic. And so that's why we sort of insist a lot that those countries really need badly economic support and economic development. And that, from our view, will be a great support to avoid the conflict, at least to stop the conflict.
Okay. Now, I was talking to you earlier about identifying the role of the FMLN as negotiators in a possible peace process. So in Mexico City, there was an agreement that evolved and identified the FMLN. Were you a part of that? Or
yes. In fact, let me say that the FMLN played the FMLN and the FDR played, from my point of view, one of the most intelligent cards of all the conflict in Central America. Even more important, they had even a more articulate foreign policy than many countries. They were very active in almost every single forum, political, multilateral, social, cultural, and they had a, let's say, four or five people that were like ambassadors moving from one place to another constantly. They kept an office in Mexico that was, let's say, was the center of operation for the region. And we sort of gave them all kind of facilities. We discussed this with the Salvadorians, with the Salvadorian government. And let's say during the years of more critical years, the Salvadorian government accepted that Mexico was better than Cuba. So it was better for them to be, let's say, at hand in Mexico and instead of having them in Cuba. So the FMLN was always very active in the intellectual circuits in Mexico, also in close contact with the authorities in the government. They were very, most of the time, they were very respectful of the Mexican law. They were not, they were never got engaged in, with one exception that we will speak later, in any internal affair in Mexico. And that's why I believe that the FMLN was always on the offensive side on the diplomatic front, mm-hmm. which is something very important to recognize, because in a way they manage to make appear the government always as the one violating human rights, making the government as making the government look as repressive government. So they were bringing their work out of the El Salvador, mm-hmm. whereas the Salvadorian government were overprotected by the United States. So they were the bad guys of the film, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, that also brings me to a question that I wanted to ask you about Cuba, the role of Cuba in all of this. Did Mexico have some kind of understanding with Cuba on the role of the FMLN here in Mexico or in the process?
Well, Cuba was also very careful and respectful about, not doing any kind of dealings with the Salvadorians here in Mexico. Cuba kept, constant channels of communication with the FMLN. We were aware of that, mm-hmm. but I can assure you that they were very respectful not to do that through Mexico. And the different members of the FMLN used to go very often to Cuba, to consultations, to discussions, mm-hmm. and we are positive that they never use Mexico as a bridge for any kind of aid to El Salvador, you know.
Okay.
So we were in that sense, we're very careful, and we had our intelligence sources, you know, following all these people, because we didn't want to be accused by the United States that Mexico was used as a sanctuary, or Mexico was being used as the bridge to channel military aid or support to El Salvador. I cannot go into details because I don't have the details about what other channels they used, but probably Nicaragua was a better channel or others for weapons, if that is the case, or for other kind of support. But I can assure you that from that point of view, they use mainly our, let's say, daily flights to Cuba in order to go there, mm-hmm. instead of sort of using other means. Mm-hmm. And but we also insist with the Cubans that we didn't want them to sort of get involved with the Salvadorians in Mexico, you know.
Okay.
And that was very important for us in order to sort of keep also our credibility with the other sides, and that's what gave us the opportunity to be to have that credibility.
Was there also any understanding that Cuba would stay out of Mexico in terms of supporting any other kind of Marxist movements in Mexico?
Well, that from the outset, you know, I think from the 60s, that goes back to the 60s, that Mexico was always very, very open with Cuba and the Soviet Union, that we could have a very friendly relationship with both countries and with others in the Eastern European countries, but under the condition that they will never act or support any force in Mexico. In fact, in 1971, we expelled something like 45 diplomats at once from the Soviet Union. And that was a good example for the Soviet Union that we were not playing games. And
these were diplomats in Mexico.
Created in Mexico.
Soviet diplomats,
yes.
In Mexico.
And we expelled them in March 1971,
okay.
because we found them doing activities with some groups, urban guerrillas and so on, that mm-hmm. we had at that time in Mexico.
Okay. Okay.
And they were expelled. And subsequently, President Echeverria in 73 or so went to the Soviet Union, had, let's say, a very open conversation with Secretary General Brezhnev, and mm-hmm. and we emphasized that particular point. The U.S., on the other hand, were claiming that the Soviet embassy was the center of all sorts of operations in the region, and they had a tremendous center of communication and so on and so forth. But I guess that at that time of the Cold War, the U.S. and the Soviet Union really kept in Mexico important centers of operation, intelligence operation, and they were sort of chasing each other. And they had the biggest embassies in abroad, which was very funny that the Soviet Union had such a big embassy in Mexico. Mm-hmm. It was perhaps easy to understand why they had a bigger embassy of the U.S., but I mean they were playing that game until the end of the Cold War.
And so the Mexico City agreement that established the FMLN as the negotiating party was a sort of a natural evolution of the process that has been building up to that.
Well, you have to recognize, to recall that we always made emphasis on the fact that we were not talking about FMLN alone, but FMLN-FDR.
Oh, okay.
The reason, okay. This is an important clarification, because the FDR was a democratic force, and the FMLN was the armed force. And so that's why the joint communique of France and Mexico was supportive of the FMLN-FDR as belligerent forces. You know, it was
and
not
the
only
FDR,
FMLN.
Explain that FDR, what does it stand for?
Frente Democrático Revolucionario was a series of political groups that were, let's say the historical leader was Mr. Guillermo Ungo, and they presented candidates to the presidency, and the only two main political forces that were not part, because it was mostly on the social democratic side, the Christian Democrats and the Arena were the ones that were never accepted to participate with the FDR. But it was small groups, many of them were closely linked to the international social democracy, mm-hmm. and also what we call COPAL. COPAL is it's a group of political parties that were set up, organized by the PRI, the government party in Mexico,
mm-hmm.
and the FDR sort of, as I said, you know, was mainly, I would say, you want to characterize the FDR, was mainly a social democratic party.
I see, okay.
So for us it's important to stress that particular point that we always had with us delegations were integrated by members of the FMLN and the FDR. So they had this joint diplomacy was always of the two groups.
Oh, I see, okay. That's a good clarification. So now, how and when was Mexico first asked to become a part of the group of friends of the Secretary General on El Salvador?
Well, I just want to say briefly that from 83 to 89, Mexico was, as I said, you know, in close contact with all the groups, not only because of the Contador process, but because they used to come back and forth between Mexico and El Salvador, between Mexico and Guatemala, between Mexico and other countries. Mexico was, let's say, the most important center of a real venue for all these groups. And as I said, you know, they kept the authorities informed about what was going on and so forth. And obviously the governments in the region were aware of this particular fact. It was not a clandestine kind of activity. It used to fly to Mexico with a visa and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
December 88, we had a change of government in Mexico. President Salinas' inauguration was on the 1st of December 1988.
Mm-hmm.
And since the campaign of Salinas, at that time was also campaigning Mr. Bush in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And so we had some exchange of views about during the campaign of both the candidates. I was at that time out of the Foreign Service for a year, so I was international advisor to Mr. Salinas in the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
We had several meetings with members of the Bush campaign as well. We discussed Central America. We discussed the fact that Central America was a key issue between the two countries, and we wanted to sort of find some ways to get rid of that as an excuse for a hostile attitude between the two countries to each other.
Mm-hmm.
So a week before the inauguration of Mr. Salinas, let's say about 7 weeks before the inauguration of Mr. Bush, we met in Houston and in one of the military bases there, and it was a very friendly and very cordial kind of meeting between the two elected presidents, who was in a way replacing the atmosphere, a very poison atmosphere that prevailed from 82 to 88 between the two administrations, between President Reagan and President de la Madrid. Mm-hmm. In fact, Central America became the excuse for, let's say, for the U.S. to start the certification process on drugs, to start also the legislation against immigrants to the United States. Let's say the background of this was the fact that the two countries disagree on Central America, mm-hmm. so the U.S. retaliate on the bilateral front on drugs and migration. Mm-hmm. We still have these two thorny issues, but for different reasons. But that was the year, the years where the U.S. created the IRCA on migration and also the certification process on drugs. Mm-hmm. So Salinas and Bush decided from the very beginning, from the outset, to sort of create the mechanisms to stop having Central America as a thorny issue between the two countries. And both they accepted that the UN should play a bigger role.
In that meeting in Houston?
In Houston, maybe. It was discussed, that particular point. And that was 22nd of November. Salinas was inaugurated on the 1st of December, 88. And it was discussed that the UN should play a key role on this. In fact, we invited the Secretary General Perez de Cuellar, who was very, let's say, skeptical about playing a key role. And the reason why Perez de Cuellar was skeptical is because, first of all, he was a Latin American. Secondly, he tried several times in good faith, and he always found the U.S. and the Soviet Union right in the middle, mm-hmm. and he never found the support of the region. So Javier Perez de Cuellar was, as I said, you know, reluctant to get involved into this. Mm-hmm. So during the inauguration ceremonies, Secretary General Perez de Cuellar sent Alvaro de Soto along to Mexico. And Alvaro played a key role. We met with the newly inaugurated President Salinas, and Alvaro took back to New York the word of President Salinas that Mexico was prepared to give all the necessary support to the UN, mm-hmm. In whatever kind of activities they could sort of develop in the region. By the same token, it's important to recognize that immediately President Bush, January 1998, when he became president, when he was inaugurated, Bush, who had been a permanent representative of the UN, was very well aware of the role that the UN could play.
Yeah.
So I think the two countries became very much involved, giving support to Javier Perez de Cuellar and giving them assurances that the two countries were on the same track, which was almost impossible for them to believe after so many years, from 79 to 88, that we were really openly having political fights in the UN, OAS, and so on and so forth, with having completely different points of view on how to solve the problem. We had always in Elliot Abrams, a great enemy of Mexico. Elliot was always against everything that we presented, everything against that we had in mind. He always had the impression that we were an evil force in the region. Elliot was out of the picture. We had Bernie Aronson in the State Department.
Right, yeah.
And Bernie was, from the outset, they say, much more open, flexible, mm-hmm. to understand, and sort of particularly trying to put together, let's say, a common front between Mexico and the United States. In the UN, I was appointed an ambassador there, and I found perhaps the most able diplomat that I ever met in my life, and Thomas Pickering.
Yes, yes.
Pickering was not only an able guy, but had experience, or had been an ambassador to El Salvador. He knew the region, he spoke the language, and he was also a tremendous force supporting, let's say, a new attitude of the UN in the region. So I guess that, from my point of view, explains the change attitude that the region sent to Pérez de Cuellar, to the UN, and why Pérez de Cuellar decided to sort of also change attitude towards the region, because he found out that in good faith, not only Mexico and the US, but other countries that were aware of the fact that Mexico and the US were in the same track, were also giving open and full support to the different peace process. We start with convincing the Nicaraguans to having elections, and then to recognize the fact that whatever the outcome, and whoever will win, the Sandinistas will accept. And I think we help Pérez de Cuellar to keep under control the OAS, that the OAS wanted to play a key role. But we always, I mean, the OAS at that time particularly was not well seen by many countries, and mainly for the rebel movements. And so we kept the UN as the leading force.
Okay, let me just get some clarification on the role of the OAS. Was it primarily the U.S. as the member of the OAS that was causing the obstruction? And when you talk about the rebel forces, are you speaking of the Contras?
Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely, yeah. Okay. Yes, that's the reason why, you know, we didn't want the OAS, and not only Mexico, but let's say the most important actors in the region were very resentful and very skeptical about OAS because of the past role supporting the other forces, and the fact that the U.S. had such an influence there, we didn't want them to participate so actively.
And what was the role of the Secretary General Baena Suárez?
I would say that he was always very constructive, but I'd say that the OAS, as I said before, had no leverage in the region, you know. And Baena Suárez, a good diplomat, I mean, didn't have the opportunity to approach, let's say, the radical members of the various liberation movements in the region. So, I mean, his role was, from my point of view, very limited.
Okay, okay. So now back to my other question about the group of friends, mm-hmm. as to how you were approached on that, or how that began and when
yes.
that began.
Yeah, I mean, once Alfredo Cristiani was elected, we found with great surprise that because he was selected as a candidate of the most radical rightist party arena, and we were really surprised about the fact that Cristiani had such a interest, such a big interest on doing something concrete and positive in his own country. I think from the outset Cristiani was very constructive, and he had to sort of convince others, including Mexico, he was acting in good faith.
Mm-hmm.
And I personally had a tremendous doubts about someone coming out of arena, mm-hmm. suddenly sort of trying to make peace in his own country. But we sort of were convinced soon that he was acting in good faith. He had the decision, he had the will to do so. And when the first talks between El Salvador government, the Salvadorian government with Cristiani and the Secretary General in the one hand, and the FMLN and the UN and the FMLN in Mexico, So we discussed, you know, a role for the UN to be played.
Okay.
I think that in 1990 it was clear and obvious that nobody was going to win the war. And it was kind of a standstill, people was being killed. I think it was the end of the Cold War, and it was clear for the FMLN that very sooner rather than later they will be suffering from the lack of support from the former Soviet Union, from other Eastern European countries, even from crazy people like Gaddafi. So I think that they sort of move wisely to a negotiating position. On the other hand, Christiani received, let's say, clear indications from the U.S. that they could not really prolong the channel of dollars to the military there, that the conditions were different, and it was better for Christiani to think about how to go a step or several steps forward in order to bring peace to El Salvador. And I think that what I want to say is that both sides, you know, for different reasons, they reached the same conclusion. Nobody was going to win the war, and their own, let's say, godparents, the Soviet Union and the U.S., mm-hmm. were not really prepared to continue giving the open support they were giving in the end.